Com.
Would you believe that champions weren't measured by rings, but by a crown? That the history books were written on dirt? That the greatest of all time was a horse?
He is running like a tremendous machine.
Experience the magic at this year's Belmont Stakes as we honor the 50th anniversary of Secretariat's legendary Triple Crown Triumph. Join the celebration at Belmont Park on Saturday, June 10th. Tickets on sale now at BelmontStakes.com.
Sirius XM Sports presents At the Races with Steve Bick. Horse racing, handicapping, interviews. This is At the Races with Steve Bick.
We're back, and second half on this Monday after Black Eyed Susan, Pimlico Special, Preakness weekend, and hearing Greg Wolf talking about Belmont Stakes, less than 3 weeks away, obviously. For those of you that haven't seen yet the prospective Belmont field, and this will probably keep morphing, but right now there's quite a nice bulky group, starting with, for those that haven't heard, I mean, Mage is going to get a 30-day freshening, and everybody that's not going to Belmont is looking ahead to the Travers and the Haskell. You can sense that already. But Tappet Trice, Forte, King's Barnes, and Prove Worthy, Pletcher with four under consideration. In fact, Forte worked a half mile the other day. National Treasure, Baffert is staying. Of course, he's at the sale right now. And they're going to keep the horses in Baltimore for now. That includes National Treasure, who very well could turn up. We'll talk to Johnny about his thoughts, Johnny V, in about 10 minutes. Reincarnate under consideration, two for Belmont. Brad Cox, Angel of Empire, and Hit Show. Red Route 1, seemingly Belmont-bound. Jenna Antonucci seemed ambivalent at first about Arcangelo, but now seems maybe a little bit more inclined to take the Peter Pan winner forward. Henry Q for Doug O'Neill and the Del Mar Group, and Ben Colebrook has got Raise Kane, perhaps, pointing to Belmont. So that's just right now in the top line. Pointing to the Breeders' Cup sprint is Dan Blacker and Johnny, with Straight No Chaser, who may have been, in a lot of ways, the most impressive winner of the weekend. Dan, congratulations.
Thanks a lot, Steve.
I mean, you might have thought, you had the big shot here, but, I mean, to win the way he did, was he giving you the indication that he was going to be that dominant?
He ran a really big number on all the figures last time out at Oaklawn, and I felt like if he ran back to that, he was going to be really tough today. But you never expect to win by 7.5 on a big day like that. It was just very rewarding to see him go and prove himself like that.
Talk a little bit about him coming to hand the way he has, and over the start of his two-year-old season, you had him on the grass, and by the time he switched over to the dirt, I mean, it feels like he having matured a little bit, because he exploded in that allowance win, and he's only gone from strength to strength since.
Yeah, I mean, actually, not to correct you, but he actually started last year was his three-year-old season.
Right.
He's four now, but like he had his, he came from the Phasic Tips on Sale as a two-year-old, this sale that's on right now. And the guys at My Racehorse did the right thing, gave him some time and really let him grow up and mature on his own, and were real patient. And we ended up getting him to the races the summer of his three-year-old year. But the first time I worked him 5/8, I mean, he was just super impressive. I told the guys before, he's the best workhorse I've ever had. So always showed a ton of talent. He was just mentally, he was very, very, a little hard on himself. He just had one pace, and that was like flat out right from the start. So just trying to harness that talent and get him to settle has been really the main goal. And But in the last 6 months since that win first time out, he's really relaxed and matured so much mentally. My assistant, who gets on him every day, has just done such a phenomenal job with him, getting him to switch off. And he's also kind of matured and grown up. And I think sometimes you forget, like, a lot of these thoroughbreds, it's all about two and three. And then, yeah, once like this, he's just got better and better and better. And he seems like he's just peaking now in the middle of his four-year-old year.
That's perfect. He's out of a Johannesburg mare. I mentioned Spitzer early this morning when I was kind of, you know, tipping the hand that you were going to join us and talk about this. And, of course, Spitzer with an unfortunate passing early after having relocated to Canada. He's gotten a lot of nice horses. This was a $110,000 Timonium purchase. So you're back you're back on the scene, looking for more, straight no chasers. This, you know, the 107 buyer and you mentioned, Oaklawn. And of course, at the end of last year, he tried the Malibu and actually did not run badly, you know, given that it was a stakes debut and against grade one competition. But it feels like he'll be the grade one competition as the summer turns toward the fall.
Yeah, I hope so. And I think most likely will be, you know, if everything goes, he came out of the race well. And as long as he stays sound and does well over the next period training wise, then we'd like to probably point for a grade one next time out. That's as far as I know right now. But I mean, I think it's half the battle with, you know, or most of the battle with these horses is just finding the talent. You know, he's a really talented horse. And, you know, the guys that picked him out at the sale, you know, Phil Hager and Nick Hines, they did such a great job seeing that and taking a shot on him. And I think, you know, it's just, as I said, you got to find the talent, and they did a great job, and the whole ownership group were super patient, give the horse time to mature, and really that's the winning formula.
It, you know, interestingly, he broke, not broke the maiden, but because he broke the maiden on the grass, but he won that allowance race at Santa Anita on opening day or actually leading up to opening day. It was in the fall meet. But that was at 6.5. These last three starts are at 6. I mean, do you feel like he's a pure three-quarters sprinter, or could you play around?
I don't think so. I don't think Johnny, after the Oakland race, Johnny said that he thinks he'd go 7 now. And it seems, obviously, look on paper, he's improved a ton since the Malibu. So I'm not saying he won't try 7 again, but I mean, he seems pretty good at 6, so probably going to keep that going right now. But I'm not counting out trying 7 again. He's a big scopey horse. If you look at him on the end of a shank, I mean, he's got a ton of scope. You'd think he would be like a one turn miler, you know, but that's probably unlikely. But he's a cool horse. And, you know, when we had him ready last summer before his debut, we were planning to run him on Dirks. He was obviously a super workhorse on the main track, and we were going to run him at LaSalle, and then he had a little mucus in his final scope after his final work, and so we missed that race. And then the dirt race at Del Mar was scheduled right in the end of the book in like August, so I was like, shoot, where are we going to go? And they had that 5/8 turf race right opening weekend, and I talked to Joe Moran, and I was like, hey, let's just go here. No one's going to beat this horse at 5/8. So he just came out like a rocket, and then the rest you can see on paper what happened.
Well, and given your origins in terms of you know, quick horses early, you certainly understand, you know, horses with early foot and you know, how to sustain it.
Yeah, I mean, it's just natural talent, really, this horse. He's always been really quick. And I think the main battle has just been his mind, getting him to settle. You know, he came out of the two-year-old sales, but they have to get him fired up to run that quick eighth of a mile. And so just to kind of get him back switched off where he can relax and stand well in the gate. And I think that all really came together. If you look back at the Oaklawn race, he actually was kind of goofing around in the gate, and he actually broke a step slow, but he's so fast and so talented. He made up for that in about 10 jumps, you know, and then thankfully this time, at Pimlico on Saturday, he didn't break a step slow. He came out like bang, like a rocket, and then it was, you know, then he's even tougher to beat. So, and it's you know, as long as he keeps his mind settled, I think he's going to keep improving.
Well, and Johnny, who, as I mentioned, Johnny's going to join us next. Pretty nice Saturday for him, and shows his, you know, shows his versatility too. The Hall of Famer, you know, winning his first Preakness later in the day, but you know, very.
No, look, Johnny Velasquez is one of the classiest guys you will ever meet, aside from being one of the greatest jockeys of all time. I mean, and just he's just such a great guy. I'm really thankful, lucky to have him be on the horse for the last two starts. And I love Edwin Maldonado too. He does a great job. But Johnny's really suits his horse very well. He really gets the horse to switch off. You know, even though he's going very quick, he seems just to get on with really well with the horse. And I'm just thankful for Johnny just riding so well and being such a great guy.
Well, I just let him know that he was a few minutes away, and I said, I got Dan Blacker. He's doting on you now.
It's like at least like 60% of that is true.
Oh, I love it. Dan.
I'm just kidding.
one challenge. I mean, in terms of the grade ones, I mean, we've got, I mean, the summer at Saratoga, certainly with the opportunities. Do you take him home right away?
He's flying back to California tomorrow morning.
Okay.
For sure.
Okay.
You know, and I think he typically, he's not a really big, heavy horse. He puts a lot into his races, and the result of that, he just needs a little time to kind of recover and build himself back up after each one. So, you know, I'm thinking grade one next, but I have no firm plans where we're going to go. It's tough because, like, you got, and the thing about California versus the East Coast is, like, he's, you know, a horse that comes out and goes 22 flat out of the gate. And it seems like, when we're on the East Coast, he's the only one there, like with his head in front. And whereas when you're in California, you go 22, there's three others lined up next to you. So it's just the difference between the two jurisdictions right there.
100%. And there was not just him on Saturday to think about in that regard, but there was also Phil D'Amato and Beer Can Man on the turf sprint. And then when you look at these races in these venues, you say to yourself, well, let's start with the California speed.
Yeah, no, I truly believe it. And it says something about I think California gets a bad rap, you know, and a lot of people think it's a lower tier jurisdiction, but the standard of racing at the top level there is as high as anywhere in the country. You know, obviously you've got Bob Baffert's horses on the main track are just the best horses in the country you've got to compete against. And so the high level there is just super high, and it's super competitive. And I think I really am a big supporter of California, and I want us to see it flourish. I really believe that, you know, the changes that have been made over the last few years by all the parties have made a huge difference. There's been vast improvements in terms of safety and integrity. And I think, you know, there's always going to be room for improvements, and there's always going to be stories. But, like, I think if you look at the statistics, the improvements have just been phenomenal by Aiden Butler and the whole team at the Stronach Group there. They've made these changes, and it's just everything's moving in a positive fashion. You know, I think the blueprint for really great racing is right there. We just need support from, you know, more horses and more support from the owners and to run, and hopefully it will keep flourishing for years to come.
Well, you got a lot of positives associated as well with this horse, and the fact that the Breeders' Cup is going to be run at Santa Anita, so you can work your way back from there. And
yeah, I mean, that would definitely certainly the goal for this guy right now, and it's pretty exciting.
Well, and I would think that The Bing Crosby comes up fairly early at Del Mar, right? The beginning of the meet.
Yeah, I mean, I love Del Mar. That's certainly the big chance that you'll see him there.
There you go. All right, and so probably it sounds like, you know, he will not be heavily campaigned. That you'll probably maybe, you know, see him three times perhaps between now and November.
Yeah, you never say never. I just kind of let the horse tell me, you know, how he is, you know, I could see how much each race takes out of him. And I want to be sure if we're going to put him on a plane or walk him over to the races, we want to be sure he's ready to fire. Because I know, I'm pretty sure that the other guys will have their horses ready to fire too. So you just want to be sure that they're ready. And he just is the kind of horse, he's, as I said, he's kind of on the lighter side naturally. And I think those type just need to give him a little more time to get run the A game.
Let me ask you before I ask you about the second time starter at the end of the week, Finding Love, the gray colt. How much fun is it training for all the people that are involved in a My Racehorse, in a micro share? How many people get in touch with you?
Oh, for sure. I mean, it's great. I mean, they're just such a fantastic organization, and led by Michael Behrens and the whole team. I mean, they have been really easy to train for. I mean, they just super nice, honestly, just let me do what I think is best for the horse. And typically when you do that, it just allows the trainer just to work out a plan. And I think that's usually ends up in the best results, you know, but like, they've just been really great for me. And I'm just really thankful for them for giving me the opportunity with such a talented horse. I mean, it's My Racehorse, really. I think that motto is obviously, I'm not the first person to say it, but it's the future, you know. And I think what I really like about it is that it is people that might be bigger owners eventually. It gives them an intro into the game, whereas right. They might not have had that before. You know, people that have the resources to possibly own a horse on their own, they just don't know really have a path or a way in. And I think this is just gives them an insight into how the system works, seeing how the trainers work, and gives them a feel for it. And then they might feel more confident and more willing to go in and invest in another horse, like on their own or other things. So it's really bringing in more people into the game, educating people about it. And I think that is half the battle in terms of getting new people in and for the advancement of the sport, you know.
No, there's no doubt. I mean, the club concept that kind of came to a head even in advance of the micro share concept. You know, people, you know, one buying in for one flat fee, and you know, the racetracks embraced it. There was the success that the Churchill Downs Club had with Lucas, and it got a great Warrior Club. Yeah, agreed. It's a big part of internationally too. You look at what's going on in Australia. Ian Wilkes shared when I was in Louisville for Derby. Ian showed me a brochure that one out of every in a racehorse, one out of 14.
Yeah.
It's crazy.
Yeah. No, I mean, they have just a very solid model there. I spent some time on the DALI program in Australia, and their model for financing the purse system and the whole structure is very unique and very well done. You know, they have the legal bookmakers on the track, and then if you want to bet, off the track, you have to go into the pools, and so consequently the purses are huge, and it just attracts a lot of new owners in. You know, I think it's a model that I think everyone can look towards and with envy, really.
Well, people that want a good sprinter are looking on with envy as Straight No Chaser goes absolutely to the head of the sprint division. A 107 buyer with the win on in the Maryland Sprint. on Saturday, and looking forward to tracking the success going forward. Got to ask you before we go, Dan Blacker with us. Dan, Finding Love. This is a Liam's Map colt making a second start, going from turf to dirt. Debuted going 6.5 at Santa Anita, and now stretches out to a mile on the main track. Liam's Map out of an LDK mare, Lemon Drop Kid, $200,000 Keeneland yearling. And boy, this one, it's not a micro share, but there's a good 8 or 9 owners involved in this one.
Yeah, so I have my own partnership group.
Nice.
called Radley Equine, and I started that just to try and get my better horses into the barn, and just putting all my owners that I've met over the years all together, and they're just a really group of great, generous group of guys, like Rick Gold and Dan Cutting, who just been really supportive of me. They were both in Hit the Road, and you know, this horse, he's doing great. I mean, he's a big, good looking horse, and he was never going to really be a sprinter. We ran him on the grass first time out just because that race came up well timing wise and I felt like it was ready to get him some experience. He never was one I was going to feel confident first time out. But we got him some experience. The run was just okay, but I think he's going to be better on the main track and certainly going 2 turns. So I'd expect to see a much improved performance this weekend. And I don't know, we'll see if he's good enough to beat the Baffert horse in there. That horse looks pretty tough if he runs back to his last race in the US, you know, but we'll see. And my horse is doing really well, so I'm excited to see him run.
You're talking about Worcester, and this was a horse that early on in the winter I thought was going to be one of the better ones out of the barn, and he tried to go to the UAE Derby, and that was not good. But he's going to try to break the maiden here, and he had already, you know, he's already Grade 3 placed, going back to the Bob Lewis in February, and yeah, I guess you're right about that. There's also actually DeSormo's got a nice gray in here too. That Taprit, Dazzle Me Silver, looks
yeah,
okay.
Yeah, that horse looks tough too. Yeah. I mean, there's a few horses. I mean, it's a short field, but it's very competitive.
Yeah,
I mean, no doubt who the favorite's going to be, but I think there's a few horses in there that win if that horse doesn't fire his best race.
Have you been? I don't see that you've been. Well, you got Antonio Fresu, who's got the greatest line. Not the only Italian jockey in California.
Right. He seems like a great kid. I just met him, and he just seems like a good guy. And I saw him win the other day, and this felt like this. Joe Bravo had another call in that race. I'd like Antonio from what I've seen, and we felt like it was a good time to give him a shot.
And a lot of people are giving him shots. Doug O'Neill's using him, and Leo Powell, and he's got, in fact, he's got 6 mounts on Friday. We're talking about the third race with Dan Blacker, Finding Love. Very, what looks to be a nice group of 6. Dan, go find yourself another Hit the Road or another Straight No Chaser.
Yeah, I hope so.
Starting.
Actually, the half sister to Hit the Road is in the sale. I just looked at her.
And
I'm not giving anything away. So.
All right, hold those cards close to the vest. Dan, delighted for this success for you to have what feels like one of the top, if not the top sprinter in the country in a division that was looking for somebody to move to the fore.
Yeah. That's true. Well, thanks so much for having me, Steve.
You got it, Dan Blacker. Good luck at the next couple of days at the sale. There it is, Dan Blacker. And, Straight No Chaser. Going to be serious, it seems, as we move forward on the sprint front. Moving forward, let's talk to Straight No Chaser's jock. Johnny V is going to join us. Steve Criss next, and then Rich Migliori. And I was toying with bringing Johnny on with Dan Blacker, but there's a lot to discuss with Johnny, and so we'll let him have the spotlight to himself. John Velasquez joins us, And I guess every Hall of Famer this Triple Crown season is going to get to fill out their resume. Javier Castellano at Derby and Johnny at Baltimore as he gets that elusive Preakness win as well as the Maryland Sprint win. Johnny, congratulations.
Thank you, Steve. Thank you.
Obviously there's other, there's other pressures and other considerations from every vantage point when it comes to this win. But to focus on you and, getting this win. Not that you've had a Preakness mount every single year. It's not the case, but you got to be thrilled to get this win.
Not every single year, but at least 13 times.
That's right.
So, definitely, once you chase, it's kind of, you got to say chase, obviously, because, this is what we work for and dream for, this kind of races like this, and being successful in every other big races and things that we want to do, and not having one of this one is definitely one of those things that you want to have, a check mark under that name, so very lucky and very blessed to have it done this weekend, yeah.
Well, and part of it, to be fair, and this came up with Javier 2 weeks ago as well. I mean, you both had long periods where riding for Todd Pletcher was part of your first call activities. And I mean, Todd, if Todd didn't win the Derby, a lot of times he just bypassed the Preakness. So it. For a certain portion of your career, you didn't necessarily have, the best opportunity in this race.
And you're right, and that makes it, a valid point. But you're still, trying to, chase it, meaning trying to get on all the mountains or whatever it is. And sometimes, by not having the opportunity, the chat not running something there, you got to pick up whatever is open, though, And like you said, yes, and probably not getting the best opportunity. At least I did. I had at least 3 months and going to the Preakness that I thought, could it be one of those Animal Kingdom I loved, we just missed. Authentic was the same one, we just missed, and that happened.
That's true.
But anyway, so those things that when it's meant to be for you, it's meant to be for you. And I think this year was for me and for Javier winning the Derby as well. So one of the things, even for Javier, we would live in the jockey's room and the guys was seeing, 15 mounts in Cerro Derby and Jose Ortiz and a couple guys were given, kind of had time to Javier. And I said to Javier, don't worry, Javier, that's coming. I just didn't know it was going to come that day. So that's coming, Javier. So he comes for me the next week or 2 weeks later, and I come for me and the Preakness side. So very nice to have it done, and the way things work, I guess it's meant to be,
Absolutely. In terms of making it happen, let's talk about how it unfolded. And if there was one horse in this race that everyone kind of knew what the MO was going to be, it was National Treasure, drawing the rail. And even if you hadn't drawn the rail, chances are, as Rich Migliori says about you, finds his position going forward. I mean, we knew where you were going to be, but you were able to just really dictate all the terms.
Yeah, I'm lucky enough obviously to ride the horse that I rode and everything that where it comes out of the race. You try to read the race and hopefully it comes out the way it is. And when we have a plan A and that plan, it works. It's obviously the best one. You know what I mean? So, and like you said, you all knew that, coming from the rails and basically, the horse might be on the lead and all sorts and hopefully we control the pace. And that's why that was the case, controlling the pace. And see what happened, and the horse allowing me to do what I wanted to do, it's even better. So it's great. I mean, when it works out that way, and for him to put the fight that he put down the lane with the Irad's horse and the outside of him, you couldn't be any more happy than the result that we got,
Oh, no doubt. And I'm gonna you brought it up, and so I guess we can go straight to that topic.
Do you think that if IRAD and Blazing Sevens somehow gets the nod? I mean, I'm guessing you're claiming foul, and I assume that there's an inquiry. I mean, how? You know how?
Yeah, I definitely think there was going to be an inquiry and an inclement foul, though. You know, so obviously we didn't have to go there.
Yeah,
I'm glad that my horse actually last 20 yards kind of started getting away from him. We didn't have to cross that wire, so we don't have to go there. So I'm really happy to say that my horse responded to everything I wanted to ask him to do, and he did. So. I'm glad he did.
Yeah, he didn't have to send it to the judges. It is funny because, I mean, you've obviously, it's now several years you've ridden against IRAD. If things were reversed, would you, I mean, if you're riding Blazing Sevens, do you engage that way, or do you try to stay away from him and not necessarily, you know, get your horse, you know, get the foe kind of riled up? I mean, it seems like National Treasure was emboldened by what transpired.
Well, I mean, I kind of stick to my plan all the time, though. You know, I try to ride my horses the way I think is better for me. I mean, IRAD has a different style of riding. So I couldn't go, you know, for the style that he rides. So, you know, I try to do what is probably best and what I think is for the way it works for my horse, and that's the way I approach things. So, you know, so I couldn't say why I couldn't really explain what I ride will do with that, because it is a totally different style of riding the what I do. You know,
absolutely. In terms of the way the race unfolded, you know, talk about when you. You know, when you kind of felt like they're not gonna get by me. You've gone comfortably enough the first half of the race. Bring us around.
No, you know, it's really funny because we started running in the fast 16 pole. I mean, I put a really good pressure on, and but on the other hand, he wanted to stay away from me though. Like when I felt that he stayed way away from me, I actually moved out the first part of, you know, of the three. By the time we got to the 316 pole, I started moving out, so my horse will feel his horse. So once
right.
I got close enough to him, okay, I'm in a good position now that my horse is gonna get fight, you know. And that's when by the A pole we start really fighting, though, you know. And we got contact and everything. I went to my left-handed, and he responded for it. And as I said, I knew then that when I ride, the horse put the head in front of mine and didn't go by me, and that my horse was still fighting. And when I went left-handed, he responded right away. I knew then that, you know, I was going to fight to the end, and my horse was responding. So that's the greatest feeling that you can ever have in any race, that, you know, when you actually an intense fight, and all of a sudden you feel the horse on the end of you that's giving you everything he can. I mean, you couldn't ask for anything better, though, you know. So great result for us.
and then some. And, you know, you had only ridden. You obviously, then we got to talk about Arabian Lion too, but that was the only, I think the only two turn race on the dirt that you'd had. Of course, you won the sprint. We just talked to Dan Blacker. How did you perceive the racetrack was playing, Johnny, as the afternoon wore on?
You know, the early races, though, I rode a race for Brian Mutchin in the third race, and the track was still very, very dry. And I think they were thinking that we're probably going to get rain, and they didn't put much water in it. So the track was playing a little bit different in the early hours in the day.
Yeah.
As the day started going on, obviously, the day started getting much clearer, and the sun came out. I mean, that works into my advantage, though, you know, because the early hours, it was pretty dry and loose. And it seems like the horses on the lead was not holding out. So, see, that's why one thinks, you know, how things can change. And obviously, having the horses responded, you know, for the things you wanted to do, and how everything changes, how the day goes on, and how the track is playing, and how the track is getting tighter and tighter. So that works into my advantage to change things the way I think, you know, and how we can, you know, manage our horses, and hopefully they do the things that you expect them to do, you know.
Exactly. And it certainly seemed like the inside wasn't perhaps the place to be early in the day, and I was just curious, you know, to see what your thoughts were. And
100% right. I mean, and that's what I said. Early in the day, It was kind of drizzly, and it was 10:30 in the morning when the race started. When I got there, you know, it was kind of drizzly and dark and everything. And I think they probably were expecting the little showers and everything that never happened and that never developed the way it was supposed to. And once there, you know, by 11:30, you know, the sun came out and looks beautiful. And, so it changed. So now you can see they start adding more water to the track and then the track getting tighter. But the first four or five races, you know, the rail was kind of dead and dry, so it really changed as the day went on. So things that we have to pay attention, you know, and it helps so to, you know, to see where you want to be and stuff like that. So you got a great point right there.
Johnny, you've ridden National Treasure all of the starts except for the American Pharoah when Ramon Vasquez got the call and Cave Rock, his stablemate, beat him that day. Talk about how this horse, because it has seemed like he was kind of one-paced and hasn't taken a big step forward. It seems like he's been sort of consistent, you know, pretty much since the Breeders' Cup Juvenile, at least.
Yeah, I think he's been very consistent and finally put him together, though, you know. Like I said, it's just one of the things that getting his mind into the business and do a thing. But like you said, he's been very consistent, just putting it together, and finally it seems to get it done, you know.
Well, this is excuse me. This is a fabulous way to, you know, add to the resume. There seems like a likelihood, Johnny, that National Treasure might go forward too. Bob Baffert is keeping him in Baltimore. Arabian Lion 2, who I want you to comment on, but the indication I guess you gave Bob was that the mile and a half should suit him fine.
I thought so. Look, he's always gallops out really, really strong after the races, you know. So it's a horse that been a little bit difficult to figure him out, you know. I guess, I mean, it would blinkers on, blinkers off. So that's all things that has changed with him. I think the blinkers will probably keep him a little more focused, you know, in his races. And I think, you know, that's what happened yesterday, the other day, that, you know, just having him continue focus in the race and for, you know, get his mind in the business. So, and that's where he got it done. And the way he gallops out is very impressive, though. So I think the mile and a half shouldn't be a problem.
Well, not a race that any Belmont wins now are going to just be more icing on the resume cake. Johnny, talk about Arabian Lion's performance too before we talk about Straight No Chaser. You did win four races, by the way, Saturday for those that lost track. And
yes.
Arabian Lion, you had him in hand the whole way around.
Yeah, Arabian Lion, I think he has changed, especially last two races and the race before with Irad. You know, he seems like, you know, if you ask me three races back, you know, when I rode him in Santa Anita and I was asked by Bob, what do you think? Does this horse want to go two turns? Like, and I tell him, it's like the way he ran the last time I rode him in Santa Anita, I was like, man, I don't know, Bob. I'm thinking, I just can't see him going to two turns because he had an easy lead and he didn't put any fight, so it's really hard to, you know, to read these horses, though, you know. And then I rode him, he actually rode second, a good second in Lexington. And when I rode him the other day, I was about, this is a different horse, you know. This definitely, maybe he just put it together, maybe mind and body, you know, got together and say, yeah, I can do this, though, you know. So because he was very impressive, though, you know. And I was very pleased to feel what I had underneath of me. And I was like, man, he's definitely a much stronger horse than when I rode him back in Santa Anita. So very happy for him to, you know, chew up and did what he did in Baltimore, you know?
Absolutely. Apparently, for now anyway, seems to be thinking about a turn back for him to the Woody Stevens, trying to get the grade one.
Seven. So, yes, exactly, yes. So, I mean, it's kind of hard because, I mean, there's not many races to, you know, to point it out right now, though, obviously. So I think 7-8 is what, you know, maybe fits for him right now. But, I mean, It's so funny because if you would ask me, like, say 3 weeks ago, it's like maybe it'll be a sprinter. Now he's actually changed that you can go the two turns. Now we have to go back to sprinter. So maybe a little confusing for the horse, but I think he can do that. You know, I think Bobby can get him ready going back to 7-8, and he'll fit pretty well in that race.
Johnny V with us talking about his breakthrough win in the Preakness, now has completed and then some the personal Triple Crown with multiple Derby and multiple Belmont wins, obviously, to go with all of this. Johnny, I've got to ask, because before we talk about Dan Blacker and Straight No Chaser, how as now a regular rider for the barn, essentially, for the Baffert barn, how do you view the challenge and the tragedy on Saturday, and I suppose, and not that you had ever ridden having a meltdown, but I mean, it might have been fortuitous simply that that Louis got the call, and I'm just looking to see how you are personally viewing some of the tumultuous and vitriol that is surrounding the barn.
Yeah, it's crazy though. You know, it's like I don't think that this is part of our job, and accident can happen in any barn. You know, so I mean, I had the same situation when I rode for Todd. You know, I had some horses, you know, sure, having unfortunately times when I rode for them. So you know, this can happen to any trainer and at any time at any moment. So we hope that that this accident doesn't happen very often, but you know, but they do happen. You know, a little too often. So. You know, things that we have to expect, and things that you have to feel the horses, how they warm up and how they start running, and hopefully we can have a better feeling on the need of you that things happen that don't happen like that, though, you know.
Yeah.
But again, you know, it's things that happen with horses that we have no explanation. I went back to see the races with that horse, and I looked all the breeze that horse had before it prior. I mean, that horse was working lights out, you know. And to have something like that happen in the race is just incredible. You know, you don't see those things that often. So it's a very unfortunate thing to happen for everybody, but this is our job. This is what we do. We expect it, you know, hopefully it never happens again, or to any horse or any jockey, basically. But yeah, there's scary times, absolutely. But, you know, and hopefully with the highs, I think, coming in, you know, hopefully, you know, in the near future, we can put some sort of x-ray machine, or I forget the name, what do you call it, that, you know, the,
sure,
the but before
scans.
The races,
yep,
before the race, so even the day before or something like that, we can check on the horses, and because there's some horses that don't show any signs of or any, you know, injury, you know, so if they can see something prior to that, maybe to minimize this kind of injuries like that, it would be great, though, you know. So
of course,
that's the only thing that we can work on in the near future, to, you know, something like that, horses that being, you know, running and working really good in the morning and they don't show any signs or anything like that, and maybe we can catch up those things like that, you know.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
Johnny, talk about Straight No Chaser, and I'm trying to remember, have you won a Breeders' Cup sprint?
I have, yes, I have.
Okay. All right.
But so, I'm looking forward. This horse, I mean, Dan has done such a great job with this horse, and I'm lucky to be on his horse. Obviously, I got the mount going in Oakland, and then I come back here again, and he was more impressive this time than the first time I got on him. What a great job Don's done with this horse. I mean, I loved it. One of probably, you know, winning the Preakness, it was actually the cherry on top of the cake, if you will. But riding him, it was so much fun. You know, that the feeling that I get with this horse is incredible, man. It's like, he's so fast and so generous, and oh my God, every feeling that you can get straight siding to be on top of this horse, that's what I got. So very, very nice to, you know, to have the opportunity to be on top of this horse. And I told Dan, like, texted him last night. It's like, man, thank you for the opportunity, man. This horse was so much fun. The easiest win that I got on the weekend. So very, 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 very much fun, and I appreciate it, you know?
Well, and I'm just realizing that, of course, the Breeders' Cup win came with Spitestown, who has a hand in this horse, because this one's a son of Spitester.
Yes. Yes, very true. So things coming back again. I'm old enough to say that.
Well, you're old enough a couple times over. Come on. Johnny, on that topic, and before I let you go, Steve Christ is going to join us next. On that topic, I mean, you're riding as well as you ever have. You're winning, as often, big races as you have in years. I mean, are you surprised at how this, you made the move, and it's no knock on Angel, but you made the move to Ron Anderson, and it in some ways it feels like this has been a like a bonus portion of your career, because if we go back, 6, 7, 8 years, it felt like you were thinking about retiring even.
I was. I mean, by the time I was 44, 45, I had to say that, I didn't want to do the everyday grinding thing. I wanted to concentrate a little more, and obviously in the business that, the bigger races and stuff like that. And I don't know if I could have done that, because I want it right. I love what I do. I really do what I do. But I want to concentrate on the bigger races. If I want to be around for a little longer, concentrate on the much better races. If I get the opportunities, if I get these opportunities that I've been given, I'll stick around for a little longer. And that's how it's had changed between me and Ron now. So I can try to do what I want to do, and it has worked so far, having these opportunities, it has kept me a little longer than I wanted to be, I was expected to be. I want to be here. It's just, I want to ride what I want to ride and try to concentrate and the better races and everything like that, and be very fortunate, very blessed that people still give me the opportunities and this kind of races. And this is what I love. This is what I wanted to do, and hopefully I can do it for a little bit longer. And if it doesn't happen, so I can always look back and say, I'm very grateful and very blessed to all the opportunities that I've been having all these years. So, yeah.
Well, this was a fairly fascinating result, vis-a-vis what transpired in the Derby and the fact that you and Javi, two of all-time greats and the best, really, of your generation, you both end up checking off a mark on your resumes. So, Johnny, always fun to, whenever we talk, it's always special, and that was a result that was, with your, as respected and appreciated as you are, it was a big part of Saturday's result.
Yeah, thank you. And I have to say, for me, being 51 and Javier being 45, winning the Triple Crown, when 10, 15 years ago, you could say that, when most people in our business would be retired by the time Javier's 45 and 46, the people start putting stigmas basically on our parts when we get to this age in our business, just like in every sport, anyway. But to be in this business, being this age, I'm so proud of Javier and myself, obviously, doing this thing. And I don't think we wouldn't be doing this if Mike Smith wouldn't done what he's done all this year. I think he's put a different precedent to our business that at our age, we can be, what we're doing right now and at high levels, big races. I think in my opinion, Mike has done and for me and Javier to do what we're doing right now at this age.
It is. It's amazing. And of course, Gary Stevens coming back with that, that little flourish and winning the Preakness on Oxbow.
Exactly. You're 100%. And Gary Stevens coming back in his mid-40s and doing the same thing, So incredible for those guys to open up for us. It's always to open doors for all the ones behind that thinks, you're in your 40s, if this is going to die, you know, whatever. It's because, I mean, if you're healthy enough, you're lucky enough to be healthy and be in the business, to, you know, to get the opportunities that we get, and we are blessed to be still be here, that's for sure.
Well, you've got all kinds of interesting horses coming to the fore between, I'm just thinking about Breeders' Cup, obviously National Treasure going forward yet, but you were on for Phil Bauer, right? 2 weeks ago, you rode for Phil. You won the Grade One on Played Hard. So there's your distaff horse. I mean, you're filling out the dance card pretty good.
Yes, I hope so that we all can get there healthy.
Exactly. Knock on wood. Johnny, well done. Congratulations.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
Not at all. John Velasquez, everybody. And as good as there has ever been. In fact, Chuck Balthazar just said, best jock all time, in Chuck's opinion. We're going to talk to Rich Migliori in a little bit. We'll see what Mig's got to say. Let's swing back, I feel like we got some nice momentum away from the, you know, I don't want to say downcast portion of the morning, but it's part of the reality that we all absorb and deal with. Steve Crist has, you know, really seen probably the wide array essentially of public opinion. Hey, Steve. Steve Crist is joining us. Steve, after starting the morning, kind of downcast, trying to summarize the weekend, and then having a review with Nick Luck, kind of. You know, we've had some nice conversations with Winning Connections. Johnny V just joined us. I thought of you immediately Saturday, trying to figure out how to approach a recap, and I was anxious for your view of events. Good morning.
Morning, Steve. Good to talk.
What did you make of how the day? The ups and downs of the day and how it unfolded.
Well, you know, we've had other days like that, and it's hard to comment about because you don't want to sound callous. This is a sport where accidents happen, and this was an accident, and I don't think it has anything to do with the particular people involved in it. I thought that Bob Baffert was probably more likable than he usually is. I thought the emotion was genuine. I'm glad people got to see that. I think there's a great misconception out there that people in racing are hard-hearted and they're unaffected by incidents like this. And I think Bob clearly was affected, and so you really got the top and the bottom of the game in one afternoon for one guy.
And of course, because he's been in the crosshairs and involved with the assorted controversies and disqualifications, he's become a flashpoint. Internally, there's actually more. I would say there's as much vitriol and anger being directed at him than there is even externally. But from the external portion, Steve, what are we supposed to do now as an industry? I mean, everybody internally understands that there's spates of injury that we get these, but the overall message that we can convey is a positive one about declining fatalities. But that, I don't want to say it rings hollow because it's a success. You can never market fatalities positively. But what do you make of the landscape right now, and how should the industry react and respond?
Well, there are no fixes that we're not implementing. I think people who pay attention to racing once or twice a year, they come in, they see something like this, and they go, well, they're not doing enough. They need to be doing something different. And the reality is that they, the industry is doing something different, and these, you know, declines in breakdowns and fatality, they're pretty amazing. I mean, they're, you know, you're talking about 40% and 50% reductions, you know, over a 1 or 2 year period. So I think this is all going in the right direction. It's never going to get to zero. I don't care what you do. It isn't. The racehorse is not a very well constructed animal. They're fragile. And it's going to happen, but I think it's great that it's happening so much less often than it did in the past, and that's a message that's not getting out there. As you say, it seems to ring hollow with, you know, the general public, but I think these are very impressive signs of progress that we're seeing if you look at the stats and look at the big picture.
Steve, as somebody who wrote for the Times and as somebody who published the Daily Racing Form and the Racing Times, speak to the media, particularly the mainstream media portion of this, as well as the trades, but it's the mainstream side that you know, we constantly seem perturbed when mainstream media doesn't take interest in the sport, and then are full of consternation when they do.
Yeah, well, it's a tough situation to, you know, you have kind of insiders and outsiders in the press, and you have people who, you know, cover or at least follow racing all year round, who know, that these things happen and that the industry is actually doing some good things. And then you have people who drop in, you know, once or twice a year, and, you know, they show up looking for trouble, looking for an accident, looking for a platform, you know, when they can do their own virtue signaling, and, you know, act like, boy, these racing people, you know, they're terrible. They don't like their horses. And it's very unfortunate. I mean, I was going to say it's silly, but it's, you know, more serious than that. And I think you have a problem with a couple of, you know, very major media outlets, where their people who cover racing seem to have kind of turned on the sport and they don't like it. I'm not sure that those people should be covering racing.
That's an interesting take too. How do we offset that and, you know, unify our message? I mean, this has been a source of frustration for years.
It has been a source of frustration for years. I think that, you know, the industry could probably do a better job of, you know, putting together some of this progress that has been made and getting people to cover it, you know, in a very serious way, in the way they would cover breaking news, you know, rather than moralizing and falling back on, you know, kind of old misconceptions about racing and people in racing. You know, it's so often portrayed that, you know, people in racing are these, you know, mustache twirling, you know, evil people, that somehow it's to their advantage, you know, for horses to be treated, you know, less than ideally. And it's just crazy. I mean, racehorses are, you know, among the most pampered animals on the face of the planet. They are not, you know, as a group, a mistreated group of animals. It doesn't do anyone any good to have, you know, an unsound or a poorly cared for horse. And, you know, that is a message we haven't gotten out there. But, you know, the idea that you're going to get the, you know, the New York Times to do a 180-degree turn on how it approaches racing, it's just not going to happen. And, you know, so let's move on.
What is the motivation, Steve, from that side? Is it, do you think they just sense blood in the water and that the you know, the opportunity to sensationalize this is more important than, you know, communicating the value of the business? I mean, Nick Luck brought up a great point an hour ago that we should be trumpeting how many people are employed, that the good, you know, the greater good is served by a sport slash industry as it's engaged in.
That certainly couldn't hurt to put a little more emphasis on that. I don't think this general public has been well educated about the value of racing and all the good things it does and all the people it employs and, you know, goods and services that are associated with the industry. And it's very tough to get that message out in this atmosphere where I do think that, you know, you have general press showing up at these big events. There's blood in the water and there are, you know, almost looking for another incident to happen so they can again get up on their little boxes and go, you know, racing is bad. And, you know, it's very tough for those of us who do this every day, you know, to be in that atmosphere. But other than trying harder to get the positive messages out, you know, there comes a point where you just go, look, racing isn't going anywhere, and, you know, we have to listen to this stuff from a few people every year. Just keep doing the good work that we're doing, and the numbers will take care of themselves.
Well, you can hope that, too. I agreed. How, out of curiosity, and maybe this isn't answerable, how would Joe Hirsch handle this?
Well, I think that Joe would say, and, you know, possibly more eloquently, the things that we're trying to say, that, yeah, that this is an industry of people who love horses and try their best to take care of them. But given the nature of racing and the nature of the thoroughbred racehorse, there are going to be accidents. There are horrible when they happen. All we can do is try to have fewer of them.
Steve Crist with us. Steve, how a big of a role, how valuable a role could the HISA administration play in you know, creating a new, you know, dialogue, or, you know, a new mantra, or you know, setting a different tone?
Well, we're all hopeful that it'll do some good, but, you know, they've had so much trouble getting off the ground and of winning the hearts and minds of so many people that, you know, I don't know many people in racing who are jumping up and down and going, well, HISA is going to solve all our problems. Everything will be fine from now on. But it is a legitimate effort. It will do some very good things in terms of standardizing things from state to state instead of having, you know, 35 different feudal kingdoms with their own rules. So, you know, some good things will happen, but there are going to be some more bumps in the road.
Is there, are there more reasons right now, as someone who, as you famously wrote in the biography, you know, betting on myself, is there more to be hopeful about, or is there more to be pessimistic about toward the game?
Well, I think there's plenty to be hopeful about. I mean, we, you know, as always, have plenty of issues going on within the game, and then there are people on different sides of them. But, you know, the core of it is there. The public interest is there. And, you know, things like the, you know, fractional ownership. I mean, it's nothing new, as everyone seems to be pretending this week, that this is some brand new idea, you know, to have multiple ownership of horses. I mean, you can go back to Cott Campbell 30 years ago, and, you know, people were doing it then. But I think the microshares idea, you know, is getting more people involved. It certainly can't hurt going forward. You know, we still have the greatest game in the world at the core of this whole endeavor. And so I remain hopeful that enough people will continue to enjoy it and appreciate it.
Well put. Steve, How have you fared these first two Triple Crown weekends?
Well, I didn't do anything smart at the Derby, and you know, the Preakness was really an you know, kind of substandard Preakness and a not very interesting race. I mean, there were really only three horses who could possibly win it unless something went, you know, horribly wrong for all of them. You know, and they ran 1, 2, 3. You know, maybe not in your preferred order. It really surprised me how the Preakness was bet. I mean, the idea that nobody in the race was more than 10 to 1 was crazy. I mean, you had a couple of legitimate 50 to 1 shots in the race, and, you know, who went off at 10 to 1. And the overall drop in handle, the small field, you know, the lack of horses returning from the Derby, this really was not a compelling betting race. And, you know, that's why you saw the drops that you did. I don't think that, you know, we've seen the 3-year-old champion yet. I think that this was a, you know, a mediocre Derby and a mediocre to poor Preakness. But we've got a whole lot of, you know, racing left this year. And, you know, I guess that's the positive part. There's plenty of room for new horses to emerge, as our potential 3-year-old champions.
Steve, you sort of hinted at an easy follow-up question. What do you make of the way in which we had just one Derby participant go to Baltimore, first time since the 40s? There won't be a horse to participate in all three races. Not that that's a new phenomenon by any means. I mean, what is a continuing debate on the timing of the Crown worthwhile, or is it the same answer? You know, we've had two Triple Crown winners in the last 8 years, and that is evidence enough.
You know, I'm pretty inflexible on this topic. I really am. You know, here's the one thing that racing does right, that has this series that's, you know, captured the public imagination, you know, for almost a century. And now people want to fool around with it and change it. And, I mean, can you imagine if we'd changed the, you know, the Triple Crown, you know, before American Pharoah and Justify, and we now had to say, well, those weren't real Triple Crown winners because they did it over 7 weeks or 12 weeks or, you know, whatever scheme people have come up with. These three races in 5 weeks has stood the test of time. There are no negatives to it. The performance of Derby winners in the Preakness, you know, they win half the time. There's no downside to running back in 2 weeks. And I'm pretty mystified by the failure of people to run horses back in the Preakness. You know, especially this Preakness came up so weak. I think there are the three or four horses out of the Derby all could have won the Preakness if they'd gone. And this idea that there are, what, 19 guys who go, oh, I've got a really good shot at winning the Belmont if I skip the Preakness. I mean, only one horse can win the Belmont, too. You know, what's wrong with running in a million, you know, six purse race and running second or third in that race, even if you don't win it? So I don't know why more people don't run in the Preakness. You know, American racehorses can run back in 2 weeks. They do it all the time. And the idea that, you know, the game has changed so much that we can only run horses once a month, I think is ridiculous. It's not fair to the horses. It's not fair to the game.
Well, well said. One thing I don't remember doing while we were waiting for a Triple Crown winner. I don't remember going back and trying to see how much hubbub there was while they were waiting for Secretariat to come along, right? I mean, 1948 to 1973, that was a pretty big stretch. Was there the same clamoring? I mean, you probably started paying attention in the late 60s, early 70s.
You know, I started covering racing right after the Spade of Triple Crowns in the 70s. So, you know, I lived through that, you know, enormous gap from, you know, Affirm to American Pharoah. And, you know, the fact that we have these, you know, three times in the 70s and then an almost 30-year wait, and then twice in the 2010s. I mean, there's this wonderful randomness to it. And, you know, if you think of all the people, not just Steve Coburn, who said, we'll never have another Triple Crown winner, you know, American horses can't run three races in 5 weeks, and then along come American Pharoah and Justify. And I think that, you know, that kind of wonderful randomness of how often this happens, and it happens in clubs, and then it doesn't happen. I mean, that's one of the great enticements and selling points of the Triple Crown. That, you know, you might see it next year, you might not see it for 25 years. And, you know, I think that's such a positive for racing and for this series. I don't know why people want to change that. I really don't.
Well, we don't want to change Steve Christ either. Steve, thank you.
Anytime.
The great Steve Crist. Can't be beat. Let's get to Mig with just about a little less than 20 to fill out. And I love the opportunity to bring Byer and Crist after, you know, after these kinds of weekends. You get a perspective that we miss. We miss the pages of the Washington Post, the pages of the Daily Racing Form. Rich Migliori standing by, and hey, Richie. I've certainly invoked you enough times this morning, so it's perfect that we'll spend the last 15 minutes of the morning with you. I mentioned you with Johnny, and just like I asked you 2 weeks ago, you know, how about Javi winning his first Derby? Here's Johnny winning his first Prix.
Yeah, I mean, listen, not that he needed any more embellishment on an incredible resume already, but I'm sure it feels awful good to, you know, tick that one off the box. And, you know, one thing that's been incredible about Johnny to me, and, you know, you watch riders over time, and one of the first things you notice is their legs just aren't quite the same. You know, there's not that solid foundation, and Johnny's legs are still the same as it's been for years. I mean, and that's remarkable to me. You know, I think Angel did an amazing job with Johnny, you know, particularly early on in his career, but I think he reached a point where he wanted to, you know, not ride as many every day. And one thing about Angel, his singular focus was riding when he rode. He'd ride anything, anytime, anywhere. He wanted to be leading rider, wanted, you know, Saratoga obviously was a huge focus. And Johnny wasn't that interested in that stuff anymore. And I don't think Angel could ever wrap his head around it because that wasn't him. You know, he was a guy who was going to ride a maiden 20, you know, and just as hard as he was a grade one. And I think, you know, Johnny needed to kind of almost take a little bit of a step back to be able to maintain the form that he has and has continued to maintain. I think it's fun for me to watch. Listen, I was done at 44. I obviously, you know, banged up, injured and stuff. So to watch these guys be able to do it at this level, you know, older than I was when I had to retire, I'm super proud of them. I think it's fantastic. And, you know, I hate that great stories like this maybe get a little overshadowed by, you know, other things that we have to deal with in our industry that are unfortunate and sensationalized, but great story, great ride. You know, I have my opinions about other rides, but I thought he rode a tremendous race.
Well, and I kind of brought up, you know, the way in which the stretch duel unfolded, and I think Chad, from what I could tell, was polite about what transpired. I mean, talk about the race, because, you know, one very clear storyline was the potential for National Treasure to dictate terms. Obviously, when First Mission came out, that was going to take away some outside pressures, you know, stalking type trip from a foe. You know, Coffee with Chris, it was there for just a little bit. But, I mean, there really wasn't, you know, the obvious candidates to, you know, to apply pressure. I mean, I sort of discounted the inability of Mage to stay closer to the pace and not have to be left with a lot to do and still have finish. In fact, he did not, he was not able to show the same finishing punch, even though it looked on the turn like he was going to reach the leaders, you know, quite readily.
He worked out a good trip. I mean, he
right?
was poised to make that run. I mean, I don't think you can make any excuses for him.
No.
He maybe wasn't quite as good as he was Derby Day, and he certainly didn't get the kind of pace that he got, you know, Derby Day. I picked National Treasure. I bet National Treasure because I thought the race was going to play out exactly the way it did, and he was going to get to control things. And, you know, how many times do you see a Baffert horse, you know, galloping along on the lead like that and not have fight, not, you know, they're not passed easily. And then you get Johnny Velasquez, who, you know, knows how to get a horse engaged and, you know, and dig in and fight for it the way he did. I mean, in a lot of ways, it was a showcase of the people that are best in our game. You know, as far as winning big races, Johnny making all the right moves, Baffert having a horse, you know, prepared and fit to do that. I think those are the things we need to accentuate and create our own narrative about the good stuff and, you know, kind of get past some of the things that are unfortunate. And I still wonder, you know, what happens if Chad's horse doesn't go down and lean into him and kind of poke the bear. I mean, you know, that's something that never worked for me. It's one thing if you're on the lead and you're out off the fence and a horse comes through inside of you and gets in a tight spot and you can, you know, put them in really close, intimidate them. But I never had much luck going by a horse and then steering down on top of him and making him basically engage in a fist fight.
Hey, you've said that a lot. That's a particular, you know, aspect of race riding that you don't invite getting a horse riled up by jostling him. I said to Johnny, and he acknowledged, I mean, he said he certainly would have claimed foul had Blazing Sevens gotten the nose down in front at the wire.
And it would have been a legitimate claim of foul. It would not have been, like taking a shot. It would have been something they would have had to agonize over because that was the horse that initiated it and certainly gave more than he got.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, it's funny because I was on Sirius XM on Mad Dog Radio right after, you know, they wanted an instant read reaction, and it was very, I mean, it was a head-spinning scenario to have to try to summarize the, you know, the afternoons of events, Rich. But one thing I did say was you might have had a contentious case of up in the steward stand had Blazing Sevens reached the wire first. That was part of my instant read.
100%. I mean, and honestly, you know, and it's been particularly in light of some of the circumstances that, you know, obviously leading up to the Derby, just a very trying time, and then what happened early on the Preakness card. I just don't think that adds to the image or what we're trying to portray in our industry. Like, it, then now it's got to go be adjudicated in the steward stand. I think everybody in our industry has to be very mindful that people have created these ideas because of agendas, you know, shoved down their throat by organizations like PETA and you know, others, that, you know, this game isn't on the level or the people don't love the horses or don't care. And it's just so far from the truth, and it gets so frustrating.
I was at a wedding last night, and, you know, somebody I was seated next to wanted to, you know, start telling me how terrible horse racing is, and we don't care about horses. And now the last thing I want to do is talk about any of this because I'm at a friend's daughter's wedding. And I've got to, you know, spend a half hour trying to explain how they don't have the full picture and what they're saying is not true by any means. But, you know, you're not going to impact some people that minds are made up. You know, they've been spoon-fed something for so long that they think they know the facts instead of really, like, having an open mind to listen and, you know, maybe have a conversation. It really doesn't seem to be much conversation about it.
Well, and I asked Nick Luck about this and Steve Crist, and it's very difficult, Rich. I mean, in terms of offering a cohesive message that is going to be, you know, disseminated to the public in the manner in which we need. I mean, I've got 15 hours a week, but I'm not talking to the general public. I mean, I hope that when we explain things, a lot of times that there's people that like the game and are involved in the game that are listening, that, you know, that might be uncertain about, you know, about certain things that happen, and that we, you know, we explain things to them, and they, you know, they come away with a better picture. But doing that to people that really don't know the game at all, and are only being given this, you know, this heavy-handed and you know, rather agenda-driven message, I don't know how we offset that so readily.
Well, I think obviously educating people to really what goes on behind the scenes, what goes on farms, what goes on foaling season, what goes on a daily basis, you know, with grooms and the interaction and the think tanks that take place between owners, trainers, exercise riders, grooms, assistants, and jockeys, trying to give these horses the best chance to be not only successful in this career, but to be healthy and happy and sound. And that's what goes on. I mean, hours and hours are spent trying to figure out the best way to handle these horses and treat these horses properly and keep them sound and healthy. You know, I know there's been a lot of pushback from some horse people about HISA and different things. And, you know, it makes us all come together and understand that we all have to do better, whether it's the way we communicate and the way we present ourselves and our industry, and that we all have a responsibility to represent it in a way that we can all be proud of. And that means no shortcuts. That means not making it about yourself. That means not, you know, tolerating when you see somebody not doing it properly with a horse. You know, the way I likened it always, and I'm very difficult to work with on my farm, is I look at my horses like my children. And if I paid someone to babysit my child and they didn't feed my child properly, or they didn't, you know, make sure my child was safe, if they didn't make sure my child got outside and got some fresh air, what would I do? I'd probably be looking at a lawsuit because I'm going to go off. And a horse can't get out of the stall and, you know, go get something in the refrigerator to eat. A horse can't make his stall. So, like, if you see somebody not doing it right, it's your responsibility to step in, because a one bad apple, the narrative is we're all bad apples. And it's just not the case. So I think we've all got to take that responsibility very serious. And then, obviously, whatever we can do to make it better and safer for the horses, you know, nuclear scans, I think, are the thing that maybe in the future, if it saves one horse's life, that, you know, things don't show up. They're big animals. Some of them you don't feel, you know, some underlying problem, or they don't really telegraph it. And, you know, we talk about all the time horse whisperers. There's no horse whisperers. It's horse listeners. But sometimes a horse just doesn't give you the signals that, hey, I got something going on here. They can't explain it. They can't, you know, talk to you in the same language. So you know, whatever we have to do, and we've got to embrace it. You know, it's never going to be 100%. It's never going to be a completely safe, accident-free, you know, game. But it's incumbent upon all of us to do whatever we can to make it better.
Perfect, perfect way to end the morning. Richie, I appreciate it, and looking forward to getting down to Belmont. We'll talk a couple times before that, though. Thanks so much.
I look forward to it, Steve. Have a great day.
Rich Migliori, everybody, MIG 4450. And there we go. That's 3 hours, and we'll do a lot more again tomorrow, including we've got a couple of human passings that have to be discussed tomorrow and over the next couple of days. Bill Kaplan, as affable and as nice and as capable a horseman and pilot as you'll come across. Bill passed away over the weekend, and we'll talk to probably some of his friends and admirers. And Erwin Dreiser, who's going into the Hall of Fame in Canada, the Western Canadian jock. And in fact, Aston Boya, Cineboya opens today. It's a holiday, right? What holiday is it out there? And Timonium's underway. So we got lots to do, as well as continuing to update and talk to connections about their weekends. Thanks to Randy Morse, Graham Motion, Dan Blacker, Johnny V, Mig, Steve Christ, Nick Luck. Thanks to you for tuning in. Back tomorrow, day two, as we recap a eventful and emotional freakish weekend. Replay tomorrow, 6 to 9, here on Sirius XM. Archive pods later. Thanks, everybody.
Hey,
with Steve Bick on Sirius XM Radio. Here in Pennsylvania, we're proud of our breeding program, the best in North America. But we're also proud to be leaders in this industry. The PA Horse Breeders Association is funding cutting-edge research at Penn Vet into equine health and safety. And we endorse the SAFE Act to help protect the most vulnerable horses. Plus, we're pleased to support the aftercare programs set up by our horsemen's groups. Just a few of the reasons why you should join us in Pennsylvania, the premier place to breed and race.
Who are you betting on? How about an app created specifically for horse racing? Naira Bets. We specialize in thundering hooves, fist pumping, and boosting your bankroll with robust weekly promotions and offer betting tips from actual horse racing experts. Bet all day and night, nationwide. Get the action and thrill of horse racing with Naira Bets. $200 deposit match with promo Steve200. Visit NairaBets.com for details.
The Pons family's Country Life and Maryland Farms are the place for breeding and racing in the Mid-Atlantic. Country Life.